Still talking about Georgia. Georgia Rippin is a New Zealand writer and television producer based in New York, working on a number of shows and also making a documentary about women working in the online sex industry. Georgia, who whakapapas to Tai Nui and Ngāti Mahuta, is with us now. Kia ora, Georgia. How are you?
Kia ora, Ken. Nice to speak to you.
Now, how does a young woman who's studying law at the University of Auckland get to be a writer and TV producer in New York? And how old are you now?
I'm 25.
Oh, my God. So, okay, how did you get there from here?
Probably sheer force. I knew that when I graduated university, I could get a J1 visa, which is for any New Zealand, Australia, the year after you graduate university, you can go and work in the States for a year, kind of doing whatever you fancy. And the dream for me really was always to work in film, and I went to law. I studied law to get like really great analytical thinking skills that hopefully I thought could provide a point of difference for working in film. And I also studied Māori, which was just really a connection with my culture. And then I moved to the States and did a lot of really radical things to try and get a job. I dressed up as an assistant, and I would Google map my way around New York with a copy of my resume and cover letter and a block of Whittaker's chocolate. And I'd drop it off at the desk of HBO Comedy Central, address the person who I thought could hire me.
No, wait. What do you mean you dressed up as an assistant?
So I was on the way back from a study abroad in Mexico, and I had like one nice dress in my bag, and I thought this would kind of make me look like I was in a corporate working field. So that was kind of my assistant vibe, and I just wore that dress probably for like a week when I was on my way back, and then I repeated this again when I actually moved to New York.
And what's the chocolate for?
I think it was probably to provide a point of difference.
Fair enough.
But it was a bunch of things like that. Like I broke into HBO's mail room. was just like trying to see however I could get a job. And I eventually landed a job as a set PA on a new NBC show that was shooting in New Jersey. Again, by like kind of fictionalizing a resume, but once I got one day's work on the show, they ended up liking me and they brought me on for the entire season.
What they would call in New York chutzpah, right?
Yeah, for sure.
And so you made your experience up in order to get some experience.
Yes, correct.
And what was your very first job that you really, really wanted?
In New York or in life?
In New York.
Originally, I really wanted to work in development, which is kind of taking writers' stories and then working with them to sell them. But when I moved to New York, I actually realized that's an LA job, and I was never going to move to LA because I'm a horrific driver. I would like crash my parents actually told me when I arrived I would crash my car and get a horrible insurance claim, and then I would kind of spend the rest of my time in the US paying it off and in litigation. So it was really out of necessity I moved to New York, and I realized the jobs in film and TV are marketing at a network or production, and production ended up being 100% the absolute best choice because it's kind of like the most amazing film school. You learn every aspect of production, especially in the job I currently am working for a studio. You get to see the product from development to production and involved in every aspect to post. So it's really quite amazing.
And just back to the driving thing, do you not have to drive in New York? You can only get around in a car in LA, but you don't have to in New York.
Yeah, you can walk and take the subway everywhere. But actually, funnily enough, when I first arrived and I was trying to get a production assistant job, they said it was going to be really hard because I couldn't drive. But then the trick you find is if you work on a union show, you have Teamsters who are the unionized members who drive the vans.
And you're not allowed to drive.
Yes, you're. Yeah, you're not allowed to. That's the funny thing about the U.S. film industry is like most of it is unionization and working out compliance and the production end. So yeah, I wouldn't be able to drive on these jobs, which works out great.
So you're a production assistant. What are you working on right now?
Now I'm a production manager, which is cool. And I'm working on Flatbush Misdemeanors, which is a new TV series with Showtime about two New York comedians, Kevin Iso and Dan Perlman, and their experiences kind of coming of age in the ungentrified community in Flatbush, Brooklyn.
Is Dan Perlman related to Amy?
I'm not sure.
Okay. So that's a two-hander.
Yeah, it's an ensemble cast, but they're the creators and EPs.
Okay, and is that your sole focus, or have you got other things on the boil as well? We'll talk about your own documentary shortly.
Yeah. So at Avalon, which is the studio I work for in New York, we work across a bunch of projects. The show I was working on last year and continuing on this year in post was Everything's Gonna Be Okay season 2. So that's a freeform show that's come out with the Australian comedian Josh Thomas. And it just aired yesterday, if anyone wants to watch it. It's a great show. And I was working on that through the pandemic. So cool to see that come out because that was truly a labor of love producing during that time.
When you say, Georgia... When you say producing, what does it mean? Because when you're a movie producer, it means you kind of organize the finance, but that's not what you're doing, is it?
Well, there's lots of different roles as producing. The kind of the organizing the finance is more of that's more of a role in indie production where yeah. If someone brings the financing, they get an EP credit. But in the studio system with the Netflixes and the Hulus and stuff like that, I'm just going to bring it back to like what I do as a producer because I guess yeah. That's the question.
Thank you.
So yes, of course. So producing is really it's like operations, legal, and business. So it's like it's setting up the payroll, all the insurance, negotiating the stage contract, ensuring all the union compliance across like the very staff in the writers' rooms with all the WGA documentation and like working with the writers for that to production and then going through to post. And it's also supervising across like every stage of production. So it's like working with the arts department, all the rights and clearances, working with post and music. So it's kind of making sure that the show runs across every facet. It's really quite an unusual job and like the broad depth of skill set you need to have, but also the depth and understanding of how everything fits together.
It sounds like logistics rather than creative.
Oh, for sure. Yeah. It's like logistics, accounting, legal. It's not creative.
All right. But for your, for your more creative part, you have made this documentary called Girls, Girls, Girls. Please talk to me about that.
Yeah. So Girls, Girls, Girls is a documentary about sex work from a sex worker's perspective. And it focuses on three cam girls, Sophia Rose, who is a 44-year-old Latina plus-size cam girl.
When you say cam girls, Georgia, they are online sex workers only. Is that what it is?
Yeah. So a cam girl is an online cam model. Yeah. So all their work is online.
Right. So that's one. You were talking about the second one.
Yes. Sabina Rouge, who is a younger cis white 23-year-old cam girl, and then our third talent is Raquel Savage, who is a 34-year-old African-American cam girl.
And they make a good living from doing online sex work.
Yeah. Well, it kind of varies between the girls. So Sophia and Raquel have done like exceptionally well. Sabina is a bit younger in the industry and kind of finding her footing. And especially in terms of platforms, because it varies between the amounts made on OnlyFans, which is a really popular subscription-based sex worker website that's really like had a moment in 2020. But Sabina's really kind of, she's been on a lot of the public cam sites, which are Chatterbait and these other kind of websites where it's slightly less lucrative because they pay, patrons pay in tokens, which is really like diluted cash. You earn about like 0.1 cents with a token. But it's a little bit of labor of love and that she likes being on these sites for the community. But yeah, she's definitely earning less money than the other girls because of the forum.
I see that OnlyFans was founded in 2016 by a guy who has been called the Mark Zuckerberg of porn, Tim Stokely, who's obviously done very well out of it. Do you regard this as pornography?
No, because pornography is, well, yes, it is pornography, but it's actually, it's not because the girls are more at risk because of the difference between pornography and camming is that porn is legal and it doesn't face the same risk that cam girls do with foster sester, which is the US legislation, which makes it incredibly hard to be a cam girl.
Why?
It's because this law, which President Trump brought in 2018, got rid of a safe harbor provision, which meant that online websites were not publishers of information. So now it means that websites police the content for sexual activity and take girls off the platforms or shut down platforms for fear of civil and criminal prosecution under the legislation. So an example of things that have gone away because of Foster Sester, Backpage, which was a community forum for sex workers to advertise their services, and also vet clients. And Craigslist also had a classified, which had disappeared because of this. So as well as getting rid of forums for sex workers to practice their work, it also makes it very hard to garner a fan base because sites such as Instagram and TikTok and Facebook are also shadow banning. And shadow banning is really when you kind of eradicate a person's presence from an online platform such that they are a shadow and you can't find them, which is incredibly frustrating and a decimation of the girl's fan base and ability to make money if you've created this huge following and publicity to then have that completely wiped out by a platform is incredibly frustrating and terrible for the girl's ability to make money.
Obviously, a lot of this happened way before COVID, but has COVID increased the use of this kind of online service?
It has, yeah. And with our girls, some of them have really seen an uptick in profits because of it. But in COVID, it also brought across a really new interest, a new issue with OnlyFans, which is gentrification of sex workers out of these online spaces. So during this time, Bella Thorne, previously a Disney celebrity, now mainstream, kind of went on the site and created an OnlyFans, and she said that she was like posting some nude photos. They actually didn't turn out to be nude. They were lingerie. And what happened was that in response to like Bella Thorne's fraudulent labeling of her photos, OnlyFans had to introduce all these new rules in regards to tipping, such that there's now a limitation on girls getting tips because of what happened with Bella Thorne's posting fiasco. So it's also kind of like taken a decrease for girls across the board because of that, for that event in COVID.
This is porn, right? How do you feel about it? In your documentary, Girls, 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 are you making any judgment at all on anyone?
No. Because really the objective of the documentary is to humanize these women and their industry. We're looking at all the media and our research and prep for the documentary. The moral lens has been really prevalent in documentaries and media about sex workers so far. They're painted as the victim or subject to incredible violence.
Aren't they the victim?
No. Well, I think there's an outdated and incorrect view of the sex industry because it's collapsing a variety of experiences into that and creating one negative view. And like any other industry, there's a spectrum of experiences for sex workers. And to say that the victim is erasing the lived experiences of lots of sex workers who do enjoy this work and feel empowered by it. And for the girls in our documentary, that's the stories that we're telling because it hasn't been seen on screen before.
No, I mean, it's fascinating. That's the central issue of feminism, of course, which generation after generation of women will always wrestle with, is the fact that women choose to do it, automatically making it okay, or does that just prove the intensity of the objectification of women? you're not taking a side on that, but clearly you're generally disposed to the first one, that if they want to do it, then let them do it. That's what women's power is.
Yeah, correct. So I'm making this documentary with my amazing co-director, Lily Sumner, who's also a Kiwi. And in our documentary, we're not aiming to solve all the issues for the sex industry because it's not for us to speak in
Fair
that
enough.
Respect.
Yeah. And were the women quite happy to talk to you and to be in your documentary, obviously?
Yeah, we have developed really great relationships with the girls and came in with an understanding that we really wanted to help them tell this story. And it was enabled in a variety of ways. So we have kind of the documentary, interesting enough, was shot all remotely. And kind of part of the way that we wanted to do it was really collaborating with them on how to present themselves. Because previously, pretty much all the documentaries of sex workers, it's a film crew coming in and really showcasing these girls in a certain light, often pejorative. And we really wanted this to be about the girls framing themselves and being involved in the camera as to how they are presented. Because they're so used to having the camera on them as well. They were also really great producers to work with. But just like really working with them to tell their story because they haven't had the chance to do that yet.
We've only got a minute left, Georgia. Are you hoping, who's going to screen Girls, Girls, Girls? Where's it going?
Well, we're...